This is a production of Cornell University.
Get in and out of here.
UA meeting, October 28th, 2009.
Welcome, everybody. To start off the agenda, I'm going to move the approval of the minutes to after David Harris's presentation, so we'll have a quorum hopefully by then. And we have a late addition to the agenda on jamming. Am I using the right term?
Yeah.
So that'll be coming up. And the Deputy Provost, David Harris, is here to speak to us on two things today. The first is going to be United Way, and the second will be reimagining Cornell.
Yeah. Well, Courtney does do work in imaging.
Good work.
Good work. Afternoon. So I'm here to talk about two different things that may seem like an odd two things to put together. I'm going to talk a little bit about United Way and then talk about reimagining Cornell. I want to start off, so I'm Deputy Provost, but I'm also chairing the United Way campaign this year for Cornell. And again, I appreciate the opportunity to come speak with you. I've been going around and talking to various groups. Marty, I don't know if you were at the Senate when I came there, I don't know if you were at that meeting. Spoke to the Faculty Senate, spoken to student assembly. Yesterday spoke to a couple hundred people from HR, the HR people from across the campus. And the reason for doing this is that one of my concerns is that I think people know the term United Way. They've heard of it. I think a lot of, I appreciate this opportunity to just quickly address this. And Charlie, who also got heavily involved and is on the county, on the board for United Way at the county. So all I want to do is talk about, I just want to put three questions out there. So the three questions are, why give to United Way, why now, and why through Cornell? And the why give to United Way, several reasons. One is that, as you may know, because of Cornerstone Partners, 100% of your gift goes directly to the agencies if you're giving to United Way. Second is the general fund. The nice thing about the general fund, you can allocate to a particular agency, and there's dozens of agencies you can allocate to, but you can also just choose to have your gift go to the general fund. And the nice thing about that is there's an allocations committee at the United Way that takes a lot of data from agencies across the county and uses that to develop allocation methodology for the sense of where is the need greatest and where is the demand not being met. And so that's a great opportunity. And the last is that there's just a diverse group of agencies. And so there's a lot, but just to think about some of them, and this will tie into the second point, there's Better Housing for Tompkins County, helps people with housing needs. There's the Cancer Center. There's the Suicide Prevention and Crisis Center, the Women's Opportunity Center. There's Francisca Racker Center, Family and Children's Services of Ithaca. This is a large number of social service agencies here in Ithaca, in Tompkins County more broadly, that are helped by the gift. Why now? Two reasons. One is the demand is high. So given what's happened in the economy over the last year, and given what's happened even locally with the couple of hundred layoffs that occurred in the last year, the demand's high. And with other things you've seen, Emerson is pulling out of Ithaca. BorgWarner has had reductions. So all around the community, the need is greater. People are feeling it much more. And we see that from the United Way. When they talk to their member agencies, they talk to food pantries and other agencies, and they find that those agencies are seeing much greater demand than they have in the past. But the other reason, and this is the unfortunate link to my second topic, is that the demand is going to increase. So Cornell is not done with solving its budget problem, and we won't be able to solve all of our remaining budget challenge, through non-personnel action. So that means that the demand in this community is going to be even greater next year, and the year after probably, than it is this year or it was last year. And so those of us who are fortunate enough to be able to help, I hope we will help because the need's going to be there. And lastly, why give through Cornell United Way campaign? There are a few reasons. One is payroll deduction. It's really nice. If you're a Cornell employee, it's actually very easy, you may think too easy, to give away a lot of your money. You can easily put down $20 a paycheck or something, and it just happens. It's gone. As opposed to saying, I want to donate $400 or $500. It happens $20 a paycheck. So it's actually pretty easy to do. You can designate, if you don't live in Tompkins County, you can designate it to another county. If you live in one of those counties, you want your gift to go there. And the last reason, and I think it's quite important, is that it's clear that people, faculty, staff, and students at this university do an awful lot for the community, from volunteering, giving money, other things. If people give money directly to these member agencies, not through the campaign, I think the community doesn't get a sense of what the collective impact is of Cornell faculty, staff, and students. And so giving to those agencies through the United Way, again, you can allocate to that agency. There's no overhead being pulled out from United Way. But it allows this community to see that Cornell University, its faculty, staff, and students are committed to this community and trying to help this community when times are good and when times are bad. And so I think that's yet another reason when I think about it. Last, I'll close with three requests. So one is, I hope you'll take your pledge card, which you should have received by now, or go online and contribute. Second is another way to contribute, a fun way, It's a Wonderful Life. The Sports Center is doing a performance of It's a Wonderful Life December 12th and 13th, two matinees, a Saturday, Sunday, and then a Saturday evening show. And it should be really interesting. They're doing it as a 1940s radio show. And it may actually be broadcast on the radio later, complete with 1940s kind of radio commercials, sound effects people, and all that kind of stuff. Should be interesting. And 50 cents from each ticket they sell for the Saturday evening show will go to support Cornell United Way. And so it's a fun way to go out and see an interesting show and help United Way. And lastly, I'd love to hear back, and actually when I talked to EA about this, I did get feedback. I'd love to hear from you about why you either do give, what's compelling about United Way, or maybe more importantly, if you don't give or you hear from others about why they don't participate, I'd love to hear about that, because our participation rate is goal is around 20%, which isn't actually that high among faculty and staff, and I'd love to know what are some of the reasons that people don't give, and are there any of those that we can address? Some we can't, but there might be some that we can. So that's my pitch. Hopefully you'll be willing to help, and happy to take any questions you might have about United Way if there are any. Yes, sir.
Payroll deduction is an awfully nice way, but grad students, we get paychecks from Cornell, but I don't think we have the option of payroll deduction.
Yeah, I don't think graduate students do. I know faculty and staff.
I'm just thinking, obviously, there's many things to factor in to be able to get that option, but for grad students, a chunk of money is real hard. Mm-hmm. But that sort of, you mentioned you don't notice $10, $20 a month. So that might go a long ways for grad students.
So you're saying, so something we can check. I can check on that to see
if there was any way to get that mechanism in place. Uh-huh. I don't think it is. It is in place now.
I don't know, but I will look into it. Anything else in that way? Okay. Thanks. So you know my address for Deputy Provost of Crown Review. If you happen to later think, and you hear some, there's all this pressure or we don't like because they support such an agency, love to know. So, all right. Let me move on to the second topic. So I was asked to talk about reimagining Cornell and what we're doing in that context. And I'm going to talk only about the piece of reimagining Cornell that I have a direct role, a direct responsibility or role, and that is the piece with Bain. And that's the administrative. So what we're working on with Bain is reductions in the administrative part of the university. And when I say administrative part of the university, it's important to understand that that's not just Day Hall-related units. It's also administration that occurs out in the colleges and other units. And so that's what I want to talk about very briefly. I'm just pulling up my notes here. We can start by saying that when we look at overall at reimagining Cornell, it's important to keep in mind that we have two goals. The first goal is to balance the budget. And the second goal, which is just as important, is to try and position Cornell moving in the future to be as strong as possible. So there are some things we may end up doing that you may say, it actually doesn't seem to have that big a budget impact. Or you might say, it actually requires some additional investment. But we might do some of those things because we believe it's critical to getting Cornell where it needs to be in the future. So the role of the consultants, we hired Bain Consulting back in, we started with them in June 8th or so, was when it started, and our engagement with them, this period here, this engagement we signed up for, ends a week from Friday. So we're in the home, very much in the home stretch right now. And their focus has been on the administrative side of the university, particularly the administrative part of Ithaca. We've looked at what, and I serve as project manager, so I'm Cornell's point person with the consultant. We've looked at where we think there are opportunities for savings through greater collaboration, and the big thing we've identified is procurement. So they do a lot of procurement down there, and they manage theirs even less than we do in Ithaca. There are opportunities, and there's started to be some changes already. I'm trying to just get data and say, what do you buy, what do we buy? Hey, we could go together and try and negotiate something. And that's something we hadn't done in the past. So I have 15 minutes, so I'm going to try and condense what I have to say, 5-7 minutes, because I'm sure there's questions out there, or I'm guessing there may be questions. It's important to understand, to realize where we are. So there's three phases here. We're just ending that first phase, which is the diagnostic phase. That diagnostic phase is about identifying and prioritizing opportunities to reduce costs. And so we're just ending that. That's sort of the what should we do. The second phase is how to do it. That's the detailed design. And so what's going to happen is President and Provost, as the decision makers in this process, will be identifying, so far it's just been procurement, but identifying other areas and saying, okay, here's the areas where we want to pursue detailed design and the areas where we think we expect to implement pending what we learn in detailed design. That detailed design is going to be anywhere between, you know, a couple weeks and 6 months. To really get a much better sense of what to do. And then there's an implementation period, execution, and that's doing it, and that's 3 to 36 months. So some things we'll decide to do, and we can do those, and there's other things we'll decide, but it'll take several months, or in some cases years, to really get ramped up to have it fully implemented. This process here is very different from what we've done in the past at Cornell, in the sense that in the past, what's happened is the provost's office has informed unit directors, deans, and vice presidents of the magnitude of the budget cut, and then that's it. And the units are responsible for figuring out how they're going to achieve the budget cut. In this case, what we're doing is something that's much more coordinated. So we've identified many opportunities where greater collaboration would create efficiencies and save funds. Procurement, you mentioned procurement, but it's just a great example of what we're talking about, and it's actually a big chunk of the solution for us. It's a case where we will tell each Kent will tell each unit that, you know, your cut is this big, and of that, you know, of that X, Y of that is procurement. And, you know, your participation in the overall procurement plan will save this many $1 million, whatever it's going to be in your unit, and that's your cut. If it turns out that we were off, that really that estimate shouldn't have been $1 million, it should have been $900,000, or it should have been $1.1 million, then the budget cut for that unit will adjust accordingly. The unit won't be stuck with trying to find somewhere else to find the $200,000 if the procurement estimate was off. And that's true of procurement, and we'll talk about spans and layers in a minute, and a bunch of other areas. So that's a very different way it's a very different way to go about this process. As you may have heard, we had a $215 million budget challenge. The current number is $135 after the act was implemented last year. And we believe that we've identified at least $90 million in savings on the administrative part of the university. That at least $90 million breaks down almost 50-50 in terms of personnel and non-personnel savings. And that's distributed across a number of opportunity areas. So I'm going to talk about two of them, but let me just list off for you 10 opportunity areas. Spans and layers, which I will talk about. These are the ones on the personnel side. Let me be a little positive. Let me start on the non-personnel side. The first one is procurement. I'll talk about that in a second. Utilities and reserves. Those are non-personnel areas. When I talk about utilities, it's about conservation. When I talk about reserves, what we're talking about there is that we believe that there are some units that charge within campus, things like IT, PDC, and so forth, facilities, that could reduce their rates, and the only effect would be that less money would end up piling up in their reserves. They wouldn't have to lay anybody off. They're basically charging higher rates than we think they need to. And so that would effectively be a budget cut to the units because they'd now get their services and not have to pay as much to get them. So the reserves, utilities, procurement. Those are the three opportunities that add up to about half of this $90 million. The other half is a number of personnel-related areas. So spans and layers, which I'll talk about more in a second, IT, facilities, finance, HR, and communications are about better use of business service centers, and then last, administrative assistance. So let me just talk about two of them and then make sure I have time here for to respond to your questions. The first one on procurement. So I presented to the board Saturday morning about Bain, and when I said that we thought we could get $30 to $40 million for procurement, the reaction was, as my reaction was initially and as others, how could that possibly be the case? Especially when I say that we're going to do this without limiting choice. So you can still buy, you know, Mac Air if you want to buy that, or MacBook if you want to buy that, or whatever. We're not going to say everyone's got to buy, you know, an IBM or something. And we still think we can save $30 to $40 million. So the question is, how could this be possible? And the reason it's possible is because at this university, sponsored and unrestricted, non-sponsored, we spend about $450 million a year, not including construction. Construction adds another $300 million or so. In those $450 million of spend, we only have negotiated vendor contracts on about 20% of that spend. When we have the negotiated contract, we only use the preferred provider in about 25% of the case. That means in that $450 million of spend, we're only getting sort of volume discounts, if you will, for about 5% of that. And if we just still let people buy what they wanted to buy, but control the vendor, we believe, and Penn is a great example where they've actually seen results year after year over the last decade of doing this, we believe we can save tens of millions of dollars recurring by negotiating much better deals with respect to procurement. The second one I just wanted to mention is spans and layers. I don't know if people know what this means. I had no idea what this meant 6 months ago. Never heard of it. Spans and layers is a really interesting concept, which is that it's looking at spans. So how many direct reports does a supervisor have? If you have three, your span is three. Okay, it's looking at the span of the university, and in particular individuals around the university. At this university, the average span is 4.2. The average person who's a supervisor, administrative side, not department chairs, on the admin side, has 4.2 direct reports. Layers is another concept. Layers is how many supervisors are there between the person at the top of the institution and the person who is farthest away from the top. So between David Scorton and this person, there are 10 layers. So there's someone who has nine bosses, basically, between that person and David Scorton. So this has a lot of problems when you have spans this small and layers this large. It has problems in terms of effectiveness. So it's very difficult for someone who's actually on the front line implementing to understand what the mission is and what we want to do when they've got 10 people or 9 people between themselves and the person who's making decisions. Obviously, not all decisions are made at that at David's level, but those decisions that are, there's a lot of layers in between. And so it's just extremely ineffective to do it this way. It's also the case that when you have lots of small spans, there's just a lot of work that gets created. There's extra meetings that occur because I need to have a meeting of my group, even my group is 3 people, whereas you don't have as much of that happening if there's bigger layers, more people that you're supervising. Also, there's cost. We end up paying people more because they're a supervisor, and if they're only supervising 3 or 4 people, but they could supervise 4 or 8, then we're effectively paying an extra supervisor supplement where we really don't need to. And so spans and layers is something we've looked at a lot. We think that we can get, not quite as much procurement, but at least 10 to 20 million, 20 million-ish or so out of spans and layers. This really interesting tool called Spider Charts, which basically is a really interesting spider graphs, spider charts. It's basically, you see concentric circles. So at the middle of that concentric circle is the head of a unit. So it could be, for example, let's take IT. It would be the head of CIT. And then that next ring is a dot representing each direct report of the head of CIT. And then from that out you have and so forth. And you have lines. You can see this one person in the middle has these direct reports. And no, these three dots in the third rut in the third circle report to this one and so forth and so on. And the power of this is you can then look at an organization in a way it's difficult with org charts and immediately see what's going on here. We've got a 1-to-1-to-1, and there are plenty of these around the university. In fact, it turns out that 55% of supervisors at Cornell have three or fewer direct reports. And there's 255, I think it's about the number, supervisors who have one direct report to this university. And so the question is, if you're not an HR expert, it just seems like not a very efficient way to run a university or any large organization. And so we've been validating this with some units. So Bain went about generating this. One, they used sort of just algorithms of just in general, what could you move from span from 4.2 to 6. They then went and said, what would be the savings? They then went through units, and then the big push after that, we said, that's great, but there's certain local knowledge that the head of units will have, but you just can't know. And so we've then been going through, and we've done a couple, did one this morning and one last week, and in both cases, we found that the amount that could be saved was at least as great as we had been anticipating before we talked to the unit. Even we didn't tell the unit head what we expected. At least that great. And so this is not about frontline workers. This is about middle management. So the idea is you don't want to do spans and layers and reduce the jobs of people who are actually getting the work done. You want to look and say, well, you know, there's three managers of each who have two direct reports. Maybe you could have, you know, two, either two who had three or one or two who had six or something. So that's pretty much what I wanted to talk about, to give you a flavor for what we're doing. Hope this is helpful, and happy to take questions if you have. Yes, sir.
I'd like to make a suggestion how to save or get $1 million or so. I asked Don Randall this several years ago, that when we started using the purchase cards,
the P cards,
the procurement cards, with a lot of things, you get some kind of cash back.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like with all the millions of dollars that are being spent, if we're not getting cash back,
we should another card.
What's that?
We can try another card.
Or if we are getting cash back, then we want to know a little bit more about the university finances.
Yes, yeah, so, but this is effectively that what you're describing is a type of preferred vendor agreement that could be negotiated. Right? You're saying basically we're going to get a return for bundling our spend. We could bundle it in terms of who we buy our pens from, or we could bundle it, in addition, we could bundle in terms of who processes our credit card charges.
Okay.
Right. So yeah, so what I'm saying, there's things like this, and we think there's huge savings out there without affecting what you as faculty and staff are doing in terms of the things you need to purchase to get your work done.
If you have a chance, I'd actually love to know.
Do we get money back?
Yeah.
I think the answer is no. But I'll ask. I don't know. I don't get it. That I know. I'm not blind free from what they said.
David, one thing I learned many years ago at a previous university was that they wanted to have personal things for faculty go through the purchasing system at the university because you could save a bundle of money. And it increased the amount that they bought.
Oh, you mean so if you're buying a computer for home or something?
Oh, you call purchasing, and they didn't say go to hell for personal use. They
said,
well, here's the place to go, and here's the magic person to talk to. And it saved faculty and staff a substantial amount of money. And what it did for the university was to increase the bulk, of course.
Interesting idea.
And it was, I thought, a neat idea.
So I can see how some local mom and pop type businesses would really worry about the aggregating effect of that. But this is fine, and I'm glad you're doing it. And you know, one could have quandaries with wherever I find our financial officers for the last 10 years, and
along
really
with everybody else's.
But I'm really concerned about the cuts to core academic programs.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're all feeling it. In my department, we saw a really terrifying slideshow by Peter Matage showing that the government department is already the smallest government department among peer institutions. They're about 10 or so. We're tiny compared to others, and we have about 32, 33 people, and they're talking about permanent cuts. Down to 27. That's a non-viable government department. So that's a problem. We've been concerned in the last two faculty meetings we've had about the cuts of interdisciplinary programs.
Right.
I just learned the other day from one of my colleagues that the CAPS program, the Cornell Asia Pacific program, was introduced with such fanfare.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, it seems like barely 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been cut 30%. I started to utterly, utterly mm-hmm. devastated to that program. The Latino studies, all these interdisciplinary programs, the language programs. So, and we, you know, we're in the government department, we're looking at 3 to 5 permanent cuts mm-hmm. in an already unviable sized department. And now these interdisciplinary programs, which enabled us to sort of expand our reach
right.
and attract graduate students and attract faculty
mm-hmm.
because we can say, well, it's not just us and
right.
a group of people, but we have all these other things going on.
Right.
They're being sliced mm-hmm. down to the bone. And it's really horrifying. And I hope you can find some way to find money to say those things, because it will be decades recovering from
right,
this.
Right.
It's really
right.
deep
right.
damage.
So I agree completely. Sentencing this chair, one of these chairs, yesterday morning for a dean's 3-hour dean's meeting, and made the point I'm about to share with the rest of you. We were in that case talking about task force reports, and we're talking about faculty, and what can we have to reduce number of faculty, the way you described in government sociology, same story. And we were talking about student enrollment, the extent to which we should increase the size number of students here, undergraduates, try and generate additional revenue. And my point was, I think we make a mistake if we think we just, all our only options are either faculty or students, playing those off one another. I think the beauty of our engagement with Bain is that they helped us identify opportunities for savings in the administrative side of the university, much, but unfortunately not all, but much of which is in non-personnel areas, that can actually, things we can pursue instead of permanent cuts to the academic core or increasing the number of students. And so part of Peter's slideshow, which I've seen, shows the trustees and freaked them out too. He's ready for Halloween. Peter's ready. He dresses himself and shows slideshow. I think that that is, if we had to take the whole 15% budget cut on the academic side, if the arts college had to take a 15% budget cut and they don't have that much admin to cut, then that's what he'd have to do. What we're saying here is, we just identified $90 million that's on the administrative side. And so that saved the arts college in this particular case, but everyone else as well, from doing some of those things that Peter's saying he might have to do if it's all on him. So that's why I'm actually advocating for, it will be a little uncomfortable. We won't be able to buy whatever it is from wherever we want. We'll have to go through a tool, through procurement. We'll still get it in a timely fashion. It'll be a little inconvenient compared to buying it wherever we wanted to buy. But for me, that's worth it if it means we don't have to dramatically increase the size of the undergrad population. It also means we don't have to have these cuts you're talking about. So, agreed.
I mean,
we're pushing hard.
People are trying to protect those, because it looks like they're sort of trying to minimally protect departments, but all the interdisciplinary programs that tie us together and that make intellectual life so rich here, those are being devastated.
Yeah.
It's really bad.
It doesn't mean that deans in general might not decide to do some things because they think it's good for the university, or good for the college in particular, and for the university. What I'm telling you is we are trying to remove some of the pressure on the academic core by focusing on the administrative side. But I also want to be clear, because I've heard from some that they think faculty are getting the wrong impression. It doesn't mean we solve the whole thing, and it doesn't mean faculty won't notice. Faculty will notice some of these things, and we haven't solved it all. But we solved a significant chunk, much bigger than when Kent launched these task forces. We didn't really know much at all we were going to get the administrative side. So, okay. Other questions? Yes, Marty? And John? Are you John? Is it here?
Yeah, I just had a question. We were talking about the spans and talking about how we have a lot of kind of just waste going into middle management.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also wondering how much that addressed, if there were any productivity gains from working in those smaller groups as far as at the like front line, bottom down, left, bottom level.
Right.
But are there going to be any productivity losses by having larger work groups now? How is that?
It actually seems to be the opposite. it's funny. We talked to the colleague from Bain, and I spoke to the employee assembly, and he said that what we tend to find when we do these cases, and there've been thousands of these cases, is that when people who have when there's very small spans, people feel incredibly micromanaged. And someone said, oh yeah, I'm a one-to-one right here. I've got my supervisor only has me, and it is horrible. You know, they spend their time, it's only me they focus on. And you create things for someone to do, and you're constantly watching them because you've got one person. Whereas if you have, you obviously don't want to get too far up where people can't manage and you've got no problems, but moving from a span of 4.2 to a span of 6 on average is still way below what you'll see in private sector and firms and so forth. And we're not talking about the departments, we're talking about the parts of the university for the most part that are comparable to things you see in the private sector, IT, facilities. You know, those are largely the kind of things you see, and we're talking about building care, custodians. We're talking about spans that are, this morning we met with an area that, in our building care, for example, our spans are all under 6. So on average, you really think someone couldn't manage more than 6 custodians? I mean, it just seems, it's amazing how small our spans are. So I think you're right to be worried about it getting too large, but we're nowhere near that point.
The devil's in the details.
Yes, it is.
And I'm wondering if Bain has actually interviewed people out there in the French,
they talked to over 400 people in small groups and more in big groups. And also, Bill, your concern, it's exactly why I said a couple weeks ago, let's just take a couple of groups and let's talk to the head of this.
Yeah.
And let's validate it.
It would be a good idea, I think, to advertise what you're doing, because as a chair of a department and as a member of the faculty that goes to Teagle Hall, I hear a lot of crosstalk. Mm-hmm. And a lot of things that are bothering faculty, they don't really know what Bain is doing. They, in fact, the word Bain raises hairs on the back of some chairs, I know. And they just wish that they knew exactly, not exactly, but in general, what's happening with Bain. And it would be really helpful to know, that they've been going out into the trenches. That's one of the issues that some people have brought up in various places.
Yeah. And one of the reasons we hired this firm compared to some others we talked to is their reputation is that, unlike some other big consulting firms, they really come out and tailor and talk to dozens or hundreds of people at a firm to really understand it. Whereas some others, come in, they pretty much have their templates on what the answers are going to be, and then we pull out a file cabinet A, B, or C. And we've seen them I came from a meeting with college officers a few hours ago, and one of them was saying exactly what's worked well, and IT was the person's helping. They did come with something, and then they tested it against folks and kept going back and refining it. So I just jotted down a note to try and get the information out more. Thanks. Where are you?
Yeah, that's a good point, Jay. Be aware of local circumstances and not have a cookie-cutter approach. I know they were at Duke before, right?
North Carolina.
You mentioned 400 and some million in goods or
yes,
and 300 and some million in construction. Bain didn't touch construction. And one of the things that some of us are interested in is, and we'll talk about this at meetings, is how much construction has been what's gotten us into the difficulty. Mm-hmm. Now, I know one answer given was it's not construction, but just to accommodate program. Mm-hmm. It's program that's the problem. But, if it's $300 and some million in construction, there must be some contributing factor in construction. And one would expect that purchasing and all these other things and looking hard at the economy of construction, rather than just we get what we want when we construct, is good. And related to that is something you did refer to briefly, which is facility maintenance management. Now you talked about custodians and things of that sort, but there's also a matter of sustainable, and I hate to use that word because we're using it overly, but it simply means saving money in the long term. And it doesn't necessarily mean spending a lot of money in the short term.
Right.
I think every time somebody brings up that word with construction or management, everybody says, well, it's too expensive, we can't afford it now. And I've read enough, I've seen enough to say that that's bunk. There are ways of saving money that the reason we're not doing them is we have maybe preferred vendors or something of that sort of selling this stuff. So I'm wondering how much Bain is hard about that in looking at expenses for before administration,
right.
And why it is that construction was taken off the table for Bain.
So the Bain came in to help us with the 215, but the time was 215, but $135 million budget challenge in the operating budget. And so that the construction part is in the capital budget. And so it's only for that reason that we said, okay, if we, what we do over here is going to have a small impact on the operating budget. Now the reality is that since we've made some changes in the last year or so, we now have a line in the operating budget that's for debt service. And so it is the case that some of the savings we have in the capital budget do end up accruing to help with the operating budget. So the procurement piece, the $300 million procurement, this morning I was just meeting with Bain and Kuang, who has facilities, the two of the Bain consultants and I were meeting, going through facilities for an hour, and talked about this very issue of procurement. And should everything that's in construction run through the procurement office? And you really have to split it out into what we're talking about here. So there's some procurement that's, building the physical sciences building. We have contractors we work with, and part of the deal when you negotiate the deal with a contractor is, buying the supplies. And so it'd be a very different operation to say we're going to hire the contractor, but we'll tell them, hey, we're going to get the supplies separately. And part of the challenge there is, if we have a problem with the supplies coming late, then the contractor says, well, you got to still pay me. I told you I would have done it. So there's some challenges there. But there are other issues where we have construction that's done by our folks, our PDC folks. Or there's some in particular where you could imagine some of that spend going through procurement, for example, paint or light bulbs or carpet, some of the things that, you just use a lot of it. And instead of the way they do things now. So we were talking about this morning is, so what part of that 300 could run through this, and that we want to run as much as possible. We don't want to put ourselves at long-term risk by doing something that just wouldn't make that much sense. At least that's the first part. The second part was
maintenance and sustainability.
Yes.
And the factoring
Sorry.
Of sustainability as
yes.
a long-term
yes.
solution
yes.
to budget problems.
Thanks for reminder. So there's a piece I mentioned. I did go through it fast. Apologize, but there were three non-personnel areas. One was utilities, one was reserves, and one was procurement. The utilities one is sustainability.
Right.
It is saying that we could reduce our consumption by doing some things, making some investments, and they've estimated, A, how much it would cost to an up one-time cost, and then what the recurring savings would be.
Right. We put in a resolution to the president about a revolving loan fund for saving money, where it was small projects. We also became aware in the sustainability committee of the efforts by what Lance Joyce's group
mm-hmm.
to do the big projects.
Mm-hmm.
It would be good if they were continuing to be sort of front burner
yep.
in the sense that we would increase the perils in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and so that's one of the things that in President Square is really excited about that one because. A, it's non-personnel, so we all feel good about that. B, it's on sustainability. It has some other benefits of not just, cutting the budget, and so we're really good about that idea. And part of what's happened in the past is that, this is the challenge around governance and so forth of, who has control of this budget, who has decision authority on this, who would get the savings, and if those don't all line up, it doesn't really work. We're in a period now where, especially, this I think is some of the tremendous benefit of bringing in comprehensive consultants on the administrative side, where they are talking to all the parties and forcing all the parties to talk to each other and saying, because you don't talk to each other, you're missing an opportunity to save X million a year. You guys got to do better, or you've got to reduce the faculty for students. Remember, those are your other options, so you've got to do this stuff. And so there's a different forcing function and pressure that wasn't there.
Just to add on the building side, I hope the administration understands that there really is a widespread feeling among faculty that decisions made over the past decade sacrificed, ultimately are sacrificing now, academics and academic policy, the core purpose of the University of the Building. I just wanted to confirm this with someone in a high position because I've gone to almost all these meetings on the finance crisis, and I've heard two different faculty members at two different meetings say that the WOW building, which
WOW.
I believe...
Oh, WOW Hall.
The WOW Hall cost, is it $4 million? Or, I mean, there's some extraordinary
amount. It's like 150, 160, something like that.
Anyway,
maybe... I mean, that's a lot of money. That's a lot of money.
But
it's not half a billion.
But the statement was made, and not contradicted by the official talking group, that that building is two-thirds empty. Mm-hmm. And one faculty member suggested, at first I thought, that all the empty space in that building that we paid so much for be rented out to local businesses.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's really pretty extraordinary. And then a high official that I don't want to be too specific about, but maybe a controversial remark, but who came to talk to my department, stated that the building, I don't know if it has a name yet, the new chemistry physics
physical science building
complex, wasn't really needed, but the chemists and physicists wanted a new building because the biologists were getting there.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder, I mean, where was the adult supervision here? Why wasn't somebody running that in? Why was nobody looking ahead at what they could do to this university with these frivolous building decisions?
Right.
And what are you going to do to stop it from happening again?
So, I'm not going to dodge, but it's not in the scope of what I'm here to talk about, and I'm putting a disclaimer before I address it. So don't. I'm here to talk about the Bain Project, which is about the operating budget and what we can do moving forward. We can't undo those decisions, so it's not going to help us with the operating budget. I think it's critically important, and the President's Court has talked about this, to make sure that we have appropriate checks and balances so that before we commit to anything, we are confident that we understand how it's going to be paid for, and we understand if there's debt service involved, there's loans, we are crystal clear on what that commitment is. And sometimes in the past, part of this problem is that there were some decisions made where there was a hope of fundraising to cover it, and that hope may have been beyond what we should have reasonably expected. And so now, while our physical sciences or whatever, several West Campus, there's a whole bunch of these things around, where we now have to push that onto debt service, where we thought we might have hundreds of millions of dollars in fundraising to cover it. Instead, we're taking out effectively a big mortgage on it. And so he's completely revised, in the process of revising CFPC, which Charlie may know what that stands for. I can't even remember. Capital Funding and Priorities. I think it's, yeah. It's like one of those things you just start to learn the acronym, you forget what it ever stood for, and change that as far as who's on it, what it does, and so forth. On the web, he's put information on the web about each building project that wasn't there before. And so some other things that he's done to try to join DeStefano, who's the chief financial officer, has required that she approve that there are funds available for big decisions that get made at the university, not $5 decision, but anything of any substance. She's got to be involved in certifying as chief financial officer. Yes, the provost is still the budget officer, but we do have money to pay for this. So those are some of the things moving forward as far as trying to prevent us from getting into part of what caused the current problem.
And your comments, in fact, were said, which led to the institution of some of these changes, particularly the publication on the web.
The new website.
Do you feel confident that those changes are enough?
It's like anything else. You get in trouble, something happens, and then you get pulled over by the police for speeding, and then you don't speed for a while. And then you forget it after a while. And next thing you know, you're going 90 miles an hour, right? And so, unless you put some big sticker on your dashboard that says, don't forget what happened, right? I think that the steps, what President's Court has put in place, I think, especially the step with keeping budget authority at the provost, but giving this additional sort of check and balance with the CFO, I think is a really important step that wasn't there before. And I do think that will make a huge difference. It's always the case you could speed again, right? But I think those things are going to help tremendously.
I think if you put Elizabeth on that committee, that will be the sticker.
Well, the more people you you get involved in these decisions, the more likely they are to say, wait a minute, if you guys get the $200 million building, we'll lose faculty and government. You know, I mean, you need, if the more people who are involved, the more likely they are to see the zero-sum trade-off of building.
I guess I'd say, this isn't completely inconsistent, but I actually don't think it's more people. I think it's a more diverse group of people. It could be 10 people, but you want a diverse group of 10 people, as opposed to, or it could be 30, but they're all from a certain area. So I think
and
it's more diversity.
And somebody can cost out the maintenance that it's going to cost in
the
future.
That's right. The O&M
and the environmental
a lot
aspects of the building and all that.
And so I think this is the positive from all of this. This is right. The positive from any crisis, right, is that you say, oh, my God, as I've described this maybe too often, it's like someone who's, you know, obese. And, you know, they have a heart attack. They didn't die, but they had a heart attack. And for many people, it's a wake-up call. And you say, you know what, if I want to hang around here, I had better change my lifestyle. And I think this has done some of that in some important places. And so I think there's a positive to what's very negative then. But we're way over on time.
Yeah, we are.
So, sorry, I'm standing for questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Don't forget the United Way. That was the beginning.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to the charter discussion, Charlie?
Basically, it seemed to me, I read the UA charter, which I had not done before, and it suggests that we have legislative authority, and we've learned a bit about what that means, over a variety of enterprises. They include things, and I'm not sure I'll get them all right, but I bet we can if we go around the table. United Religious Work, Cornell Health Services, the campus store, transportation,
planning, sustainability,
CJC,
and codes and judicial committee. My question is, if you look at these things, and I come in as an outside observer, you know, I haven't been involved with the assembly that much, but what I have observed is that many of these organizations are going narrowly on their way without any consultation with the university assembly, thank you very much. And maybe that's good, maybe that's bad. Maybe it's time to have at least a brief discussion about whether that list of organizations we are supposed to have legislative authority over really is appropriate. And if it is, I think there are ways that we can regain their attention. And if we decide that it isn't, then it seems to me we ought to say a blessing on them. They should go their own way. And so one of my suggestions was to form a small group, which will come up in just a few moments, to review the charter. But before we did that, I wanted very much to have a discussion with this group for something like 20 minutes about which of these enterprises we ought to be concerned about and which we ought to say thank you ever so much. We've done what we can and good luck in the future.
Charlie, because they're all on paper, and this goes back a number of years, what you're bringing up, unfortunately, is not new, but maybe one of the things, just so we're not reading on paper, maybe it's just a suggestion, maybe to invite them in and have a conversation with them as well to find out exactly
who is them,
transportation, Gannett, all of those entities that were just mentioned, to whoever those folks are. I mean, I don't know who from Gannett would be invited, but you know what I'm saying, right?
Sure.
Yeah. So maybe that's a part of the conversation, what I'm saying. Maybe we shouldn't do it in isolation. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
Suggestion.
Sure.
Well, there's already some, I guess you could say, experience on the committee with just that kind of process. Randy can affirm this, too, having been on through the past couple of years. That the UA has had reports from not United Religious, but from Gannett. It's had reports from everyone but, in fact, United Religious Work. I don't believe we had anybody come in from United Religious Work. But, and planning, we have somebody who is active in the planning committee, and someone who is. So I think, Leon, that's I mean, it's always good. In fact, it's part of the charter to say that these groups should be reporting to us every semester. But the question that Charlie's asking, from my point of view, is whether or not we are serious about our need to do something in the various areas, or whether we're just hearing a bunch of reports.
No, no, I'm not asking for them to come in to make a report. I'm saying we can read in the charter, but I'm saying bring them in so we can dig a little deeper. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying come in for a monthly report. I'm coming in to do a critical analysis of if there should be a relationship or not. And I'm just saying, I don't think we should do that just based on reading what it says in the charter.
Well, which ones were you thinking were most important to do that with? Because, for example, last meeting, we had a family services person come in and actually asked us to vet before us a couple of family service issues, mm-hmm. which is the purpose actually of the organization, the VUA,
right.
to look at these things. So, I mean, we don't have to ask them to come in and say, what more do you want? What we have to do is take seriously our connection with them and make sure that we're interested in maintaining that. Now, as far as transportation is concerned, we've had in the past 2 years several reports by the transportation. We in fact, when they had T-Guides, we did a look at the T-Guides, and we did a resolution in support of T-Guides, and sent that to the president, you know, and so forth. Now, the next step, of course, would be for us as a body to say, are we satisfied with what's happened? And if not, to make a resolution of some sort to say, you know, we haven't stepped up budget problems, or no, Cornell hasn't done enough to promote the values in the T-Guides or something of that sort.
Right. Okay. I think Andrew was next.
Yeah. Well, one thing, I think that half those committees, correct me if I'm wrong, aren't active at all. Also, if we were to change the charter drastically, we'd have to give it to a vote, right? 20% from university. Otherwise, I think maybe go to the Board of Trustees and we could get through a vote. But, it would be a monumental undertaking. I do think, like, getting members of these organizations involved and see if there is an actual need for a committee is something we should be doing. I think it's kind of foolish to have a charter in which half the things we don't even actually do. I mean, it seems very outdated. And I know we've had a lot of experiences with charter reviews before, but we've never actually gone the distance. We've never actually changed it drastically like it needs to be changed. And I think the way to tighten the link between this organization and the committees that are part of this organization is to actually have members of the UA be liaisons to a lot of these committees. That way you can find out, you know, what's actually going on. And, so I do think the charter needs serious review. And committee will be a good idea.
It seems to me that the first issue, though, I mean, yes, the charter may need to be revised, and there are structural problems, it seems to me. But I think the first question that we as a group need to think about is, which of these organizations do we care about enough to want to have any influence? For instance, I was on the campus store committee for a couple of years, and it seemed to me it was a total and complete waste of everybody's time, their time as professional managers, my time as a faculty member, because there were essentially no decisions to be made. They had their ways of doing things. The business seemed to be working. They were making money, and so they were solvent, there didn't seem to be any great...
Now they're not there, right?
I don't know what the situation is at the moment. But in any event, I mean, the question is that, for example, something we want to, as a group, invest our time and effort in, or are there other things that we think are more important? Can we cope with all of these things?
I just wanted to... Say something in regards to what's required if we're going to Mendenhall, you talked about how if we make certain substantial changes, you'll either have to go through the Board of Trustees or there's going to have to be a referendum vote.
20%.
But depending upon when we review this and we see where we want to go with the charter, if we're just going to be dealing with the committee structures and have what committees are active committees of the University Assembly, that's just something we need to vote on ourselves. That's nothing that needs to be put to a referendum unless we're actually going to be changing what we have legislative authority over. We don't need to go to a referendum. It just needs a two-thirds vote.
If you eliminate a committee, aren't you changing what you have control over?
I mean, in practice, yes. In theory, no. And unless we change it in theory, we don't have to send it to a referendum. That's what I'm saying.
This is really deja vu all over again. This has been going on for 15 years. And the issue that we have danced around, when I was chair, we danced around, what does legislative authority mean? That's what you have to define right from the start. We have religious work here. We have Janet Korsenbrecher here. We have Bill Wendt here. What does it mean? They used to come and give us a report once a year telling us what they were going to do. And I kept saying, let's start by saying, what does legislative authority mean? Let's legislate that there'll be free parking for the next year and see what happens. What is legislative authority? It's not just having a committee or sitting on a committee. It means that we have the power to legislate something. And there is in the charter a process that involves the president, who has the opportunity to review it, to basically veto it. You know, but the point is that we've never actually used our power from the charter to do anything with these committees. We sit back and say, well, gee, you know, they raised this, or the campus store has changed their displays yet again, which they seem to do routinely. And we, you know, that's where you start. Okay, we've had these people, and religious work had nothing to do with us. They came here and said, don't even bother. We don't want to know. Go away. Okay. And it was supposed to be removed. We just never voted. Okay. Campus Store was very happy. They came, you know, have people on the committee. We had a committee over in Gannett. But obviously there were a number of committees. We used to have our own committee. But it really didn't do anything. You're not going to have a committee in the operation, daily operation, making medical decisions about providing service. But, you know, we went around the table years and years ago and kept saying, what does legislative authority mean? And, you know, I still think that at some point we should have the gonads to do something provocative and see if we can get someone to define what this legislative authority means to this group. We use the word, but just having another committee and another member on the committee, I don't think that has anything to do with this charter. That we either have legislative authority, just remove that. And we just have, you know, members on a committee and we vote, maybe, and that's it. Sorry, but I mean, as I say, this is 10, 15 years going round and round and round.
Okay.
Well, we had an interesting discussion with the University Council about just that question of what legislative authority means. And I think one has to understand that the UA exists because of direct delegation of authority from the president to think about these things. And so, effectively, legislative authority means that we recommend to the president, and the president will take our recommendation seriously. That's what it fundamentally means. And if we legislate that there's going to be free parking, I will guarantee that the president will veto it because it's not a sensible thing. But if there are, you know, what I would call reasonable, sensible suggestions, even if they disagree with the proposals from the transportation department, I suspect we can have them taken very seriously by the administration.
Well, what's the difference between legislative authority and simply passing resolutions that we then hand off to central administration? Legislative authority means something different. You know, Congress doesn't legislate something and then just pass it on.
That's what Congress does.
Has authority to do things that don't necessarily require presidential authority.
Really?
You can make laws that the president doesn't have to sign?
Gee, I suppose they can handle stuff within the congressional area.
I don't think so. Well, can we manage our own institution of our? Yes, we can. If we take some responsibility and do something. I made a list of the 13 committees in the different categories of staying associated capitalist life, and we have more or less active. More or less, I say, because it depends on how vigorously our respective members who participate in these committees really participate in them, in 6 of the 13. So Ari is right, 7 of the 13 we don't. But amongst those 7 are something called committee on committee, which I think we could easily say doesn't exist. And there's also the Assembly System Committee, which Ari has told us is too difficult to get together, so we don't really care about that one.
I didn't say that.
We know it's Marty's interpretation. That's okay.
Well, it's just my interpretation.
That's okay.
I'm trying to convince
you to discuss
the charter and not having any results in the office. So, and we also have the Joint Assembly's Multicultural Committee, which actually there's something on the table today that we're trying to do something about, which would make that actually come back into life again, because there's somebody interested in the UA in having it come to life. Bravo. And there is the Joint Assembly's Financial Aid Committee, I would think somebody could spend some time on, but maybe not. There's also the budget committee. Oh, you are?
Yeah, for the Joint Assembly's Financial Aid Committee.
Terrific. So we need to just get in contact with you should there be somebody here who wants to do something. Well, you are. Well, fabulous. Okay, so that's an active one, too. I guess we're coming up now. We're more than 50% active. The Cornell Store and Relations Work. Where Cornell Store and Religious Work and United and University Health Service. I know University Health Services, where somebody has expressed an interest in being involved with, and I know that they want to have us do something at least having to do with that. Are you involved with
no,
that?
I was just going to finish this comment.
I guess what I'm saying is I agree with everybody. I think we ought to get rid of a few committees. I don't care. I think it strikes me that we could say that the Committee on Committees and the Assembly System Review Committee are irrelevant for us because we can't get the one together because it's too difficult, and the Committee on Committees, heaven knows what that does.
It's a nominating committee.
I think Ari should look back because we voted to get rid of that 4 or 5 years ago. And if we voted, and everyone
was,
said get rid of it.
Whoever was here at the time did not put that in the minute, so.
Okay. And maybe a United Religious Work, like Leon suggests, we can have somebody come here from United Religious Work and diss us. And then we'll be happy in getting rid of them, too. On the other hand, and this is the key matter from my point of view, we really got to get some, I don't think gonads is the right word because that's
some
not
of the appropriate.
Exactly, some of us don't have some names anyway. But we need to get our act together and start doing something very vigorous in the area of campus planning and transportation and really show what our legislative authority should be about. Put out something that maybe is a little challenging and have it shot down. Make an issue out of it. If we don't want to do that, then we get rid of those committees too. I don't know.
So I don't like the idea of sort of making a lot of noise just to make a lot of noise and see what happens.
No, there's nothing to do with planning on this campus that we can say anything significant about?
Well, I think not my purpose is just trying to make a noise. But so with transportation as I mentioned, and I'm the liaison with transportation. Transportation, the first meeting we're going to be talking about is what are the policies governing transportation? I want to aim that to say, okay, what is everybody in the rooms? This is the committee to talk about these policies. What are the policies? What are your opinions on it? And then after some discussion on that, I'm sure we'll take a couple of meetings, bring that back here. I'm more of a fan of looking at, with the committee, I agree, we need to say, okay, are there issues with these that we see as a group here, but within those committees, how, you know, there we have representation. We have those people from transportation on the transportation committee to say, okay, what are you guys' feelings? You know, give us some input now, and together we can bring those two, those tasks together. And then I can come back and say, hey, this is what TAC says, you know. Transportation is doing a good job. The policies have generally been very good. Maybe we don't need to have a heavy hand in there. Or maybe TAC comes back and says, hey, we got some serious issues with these policies. And then that's when we can start to say, maybe we'll make a noise. But we're not making a noise just to make a noise there.
I don't want to speak for Marty. He's just exaggerating to make a point.
That's all.
But if these committees are inactive and effective, they should go. Because they haven't kept up with the times. What happened in, I don't know, 1850 is different than what's going on in 2009. You know what I mean? So it's got to be a relevant document for what's going on today and hopefully tomorrow.
I also think, too, though, before we just start hemorrhaging committees, that part of the problem is, you know, we have these inactive committees, but we're also talking about, well, what, you know, beyond the committees, what active role do we see for ourselves? Mm-hmm. I feel like perhaps we should address both of those issues together by mandating that these committees become active, and instead of just saying, oh, well, you know, go do something and please report to us, actually have some teeth where you say, well, if the committees have it, so the committees have to meet every week, then they have to report to us every other week you schedule that, okay, these committees must report to us this meet, even if they just say, we met, we discussed it, we saw it, you know, spend 30 seconds to tell us that. This way, you actually set up a structure where you have active committees, we have active reporting taking place to us, instead of just delegating people to work with these committees and saying, go take care of it.
Because I feel like
it's my own experience with the CJC, a lot of the problem is just getting everyone together to meet. Whereas I feel like if we had something where, okay, well, this committee meets on this day, every day of the week, and if you can't do that, then we need to find someone else for the committee. And steps like those should be taken to keep the committee active and keep them reporting to us. And that will make us more involved in all of these things and also keep the committee structure active.
I think the only thing you can mandate on this campus is that undergraduates take swimming to get a degree. Other than that, you can't mandate.
Say, for example, if a committee doesn't meet, or if the members don't show up, they're off the committee.
Who are the members? Where are they coming from?
I think the other point that I think is critical is that we represent a constituency. That is, a group of us represent the faculty, another group represents students, another group represent employees. Theoretically, we should be bringing issues from our constituency to the appropriate committee to take care of a difficulty. So that if the campus store is rearranging its displays every 36 minutes so that you can't find the textbooks you need for the course, this is a way of really putting some pressure on them to change that behavior. But unless we get the input from the constituencies, it becomes, again, hard to do this, and our committees become relatively useful and only reactive to comments from the agencies that they have legislative authority over.
Can we bring this to an end very quickly?
Just very quickly, unless something has changed. We only had ownership of three entities on campus legislated. That was religious work, campus storage, and transportation.
CJC
is a standing committee. That's different. That's Alice.
Oh,
these
right.
other entities, you know, belong to us legislatively.
Yeah.
There are only three of them.
Yes,
right.
Okay.
We can have all the committees in the world.
The campus code of conduct
is ours.
Yes.
And for a long time, the only committee that you could point at in this group that was functional in terms of really doing something was CJC. That was our star. And perhaps it still is. But, you know, this comes back, and I agree that it may be time to examine it yet again. And that is that in terms of ownership of something, that's very different than forming a committee. And doing it. We can form all the committees and ask to be part of of administrative entities that exist on campus. We can say, well, we want to be part of campus planning. We want to be part of sustainability. They're not ours. Those three things are legislatively ours by charter. It was signed. The trustees agreed.
Four of them, actually.
What's the fourth?
United Religious Work, Transportation Mail Services, University Health Services, and the Cornell Store.
That's right. Sorry. Yeah, four. So those four, I, for some reason, I never put religious work in there because they basically came in, spent 5 minutes, and said, we have no use for you, and left.
They should have use for us, though, because we represent the community. They are theoretically serving the community. You would think that they would wish to come and have a conversation about how they might do better or not. And that brings me then to this resolution, which has been suggested by Kay, who could not be here today, which basically forms a small group to think about this issue and then come back to the committee. And it's on the screen there.
And this doesn't have to go to the president. This is an internal
resolution. It's just internal. Yeah, all we're doing is saying we want to get a small group together to think about these issues and come back with some kind of report.
And this is a point of information for everyone. Article 11 of the Charter allows that an affirmative vote of the majority of the voting members of the University Assembly shall be required to amend the bylaws and procedures of the University Assembly, and an affirmative vote of two-thirds of the seated membership of those articles in the Charter not excluded in 11.1. So we can amend the Charter with a two-thirds vote of our sitting membership without sending it to whatever, 60 or 90 or whatever percentage of it. Okay.
So the question is, here is the motion, and let me read it since it's hard to read off the screen, and I, thanks to John, have a paper copy. The whereases are not terribly helpful, so therefore be it resolved, the Charter Review Ad Hoc Committee be formed for the sole purpose of reviewing the Charter, reporting periodically to the UA, and preparing a comprehensive proposal of changes for the UA to review. All members of the UA Executive Committee will serve as members of the committee ex officio with vote. Additional members may be appointed by the UA Executive Committee as needed. The Charter Review Ad Hoc Committee shall act in accordance with the general direction the UA expresses for changes needed. It strikes me as a fairly harmless effort to get the Executive Committee to do some work.
I'm going to vote for this, but is it relevant or not to have any a timeline in there or just leave it open-ended? For example, what I'm saying, is it relevant or not to say something like by May 2010 or, I don't know, July 2010, or just leave it open-ended? I'm just asking the question.
No, I think that's a very good point, because if it doesn't have a deadline, it does not keep the feet to the fire, as it were. I don't know, what, middle of the spring semester? Or at least a preliminary report.
When? Or whatever date?
February. Late February.
Sounds fine.
What if we just said it will report, it will issue a preliminary report before the first meeting of the UA that occurs in March?
Sure.
Just so you know, the spring schedule as it's been set so far is January 27th, which will be our first meeting of the spring semester. February 10th, February 24th, March 17th, March 31st, April 14th, and April 28th, with the May 5th being meeting generally getting started for the next academic year.
Why are they
excluded the
two colleges from the
Charter
Review?
Because these are
followed. Oh, I see.
When is spring break?
Why don't we get a report back before the first meeting in February? I mean, not the
preliminary report, progress report.
Start on February 10th?
On the 22nd to the 26th.
Okay.
Great.
Thank you.
I propose it.
A second.
Okay.
The date was, Charlie?
Was before the February 10th meeting.
Before the February 10th or on the February 10th?
Well, it would be on the February 10th, okay. But a report before then.
Okay. Everybody ready to vote? Those in, all in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. That passes unanimously.
Congratulations.
12.
12-0-0.
That would be
nice work.
That takes care of that part of the meeting. Now we need to talk about CJC, or what's the pleasure of the group, JAMIC or CJC first? No.
Well, JAMIC will probably take like 10 minutes. It really won't take very long. It really needs to be done as soon as that they can start staffing the committee.
Okay. Let us do JAMIC.
Great.
We have to.
I have a question about JAMIC.
Sure.
About the there's a sentence that says the Vice Provost for Diversity and Faculty Development shall serve as an ex officio member of JAMIC.
Mm-hmm.
That position does not exist anymore at Cornell.
Okay.
Who is it now though? Isn't it worked into somebody else?
If that title does not exist.
Okay, if it doesn't exist anymore, then we can strike it.
I don't know if you want to replace it with something else, but that particular title does not exist at Cornell.
Ari, what do you think about that? I know that Ari was...
I know that the committee's been dormant for many years, so even when the title did exist, that person clearly wasn't connected to the committee.
Yeah.
So, I think it's sensible to just remove it and can always add more ICO members later when someone expresses interest.
Okay, yeah.
Is there anybody in the central administration you can imagine, perhaps Susan Murphy's office, that would be useful to have on that committee?
You know, I really don't have the biggest knowledge of the diversity administration staff, but I know that, again, like what you said, we can definitely add ex officio members after the fact. I mean, do you know anybody on the administration who
is? Susan Murphy is student services.
She is. I doubt that. She ever really
but she'd get the email. Right?
But Susan Murphy was quite active in the Coaching Judicial Committee meetings. Came to almost every one of the open meetings.
Would you know
what? I mean, if this issue, of, which has been on the front pages, you know, of the has forums and things like that, I thought that's why it was coming up right now, right?
Yeah. But it'd be very relevant to you.
Yeah, I'm fairly much on one of the co-chairs of JAMIC. Is that what's being voted upon right now?
So let me present it first. Let me present it first before we get into questions. So essentially, there have been a lot of issues recently that have prompted the revitalization of this committee. And the SA has been trying to staff it throughout the beginning, and I think they've unofficially staffed it. But because the SA had voted to increase the size of the committees at the beginning of the semester, the wording is different from in the SA and the UA charters, and we can't officially staff the committees until the UA charters and the SA charters are reconciled.
Right.
So this is just for like a
wording.
Yeah, exactly. This is just a formality.
So you're moving the resolution.
Yes.
I'll second it.
Okay, moved by Adam, seconded by Marty. Discussion?
Just for clarification, I think it's Susan Murphy. Of course, I think just professional courtesy, you would ask her before you would put her.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
You came in and so.
Well, or if you could say simply someone from the office of the, and then she can make the choice. But don't you want to have somebody from that office be officially appointed ad hoc member?
Or do you want to research it first?
Darren, what do you think about that? Because then you're obviously the co-chair of this committee.
I was just reading the reference by Adam.
Do you want someone from the central administration to be on this committee? Someone like Susan Murphy?
Obviously. As an ad hoc member.
Right.
Yes, ideally, I have Susan Murphy or Dean Harris.
But But what I'm saying, before you put their names in, would it be right to ask them?
They should ask first. Ideally, yeah. They should be asking Susan Murphy or David Harris if they accept the invitation.
So do you want to make it just a general statement that someone who, you know, is involved with diversity issues or someone from the Central
Administration? Yeah, that would be from the Central Administration, is it?
I don't want to get this held up for 2 weeks, obviously.
I think we should go without it and just later. That's just my opinion. Add someone later and all the information later. Instead of putting a general.
Because we can always add an ex officio member at any time, correct?
Yeah. So you want to delete vice provost or diversity faculty development, she'll serve as an ex officio member.
Yeah.
And then where does it talk about adding?
I think it's part of the charter.
No, I'm just looking at the resolution.
Oh, in there?
Yeah. If you're taking out that person, there's no indication that you want to have any connection with the Central Administration. It just occurs to me that given you've had panels and things of that sort where the Central Administration is represented, do you want to have them there? Or would you rather have this, you know, be like Ed is suggesting some committee that just is putting up a strong statement.
Yeah, but they can add those ad hoc members later.
You can say that.
Part of the legislative.
All right. What I'm hearing you guys saying is the UA could add ex officio positions later after talking through exactly what position should be ex officio on it. Mm-hmm. I think my recollection of the CJC situation is that they attended for that year because there were special important issues, but the committee was very explicit that they were not members of that committee and it didn't want them to be members.
In fact, Mingle is a member of the committee. And we have four appointed members ex officio of the committee, including Mingle, including two or three others from the Central Administration.
But I'm aware of a number of student assembly committees, for instance, where the vice president of student academic services, Susan Murphy, was put ex officio on the committee without being consulted first before the committee was set up. And she isn't necessarily even on the mailing list of some of those committees because it just, you know, it was a gesture, but it wasn't really thought out in terms of is this something. Ex officio membership, from our perspective, implies that the person should be regularly involved with the committee as opposed to in special circumstances.
Well, I think what we're saying is that the committee can meet, see who they want to have as their ex officio members, reach out to that individual, make sure they want to be involved, and then they can come to us and ask us and say, please add this ex officio member for us, and then we can add that again in another resolution at our next meeting if we deem it. So I just say
as ex officio members from Central Administration shall be appointed as desired or needed.
I personally think that it shouldn't be. That clause should be struck. We shouldn't have it in there. Just pass it as is. We can always get an ex officio member on next meeting. Susan Murphy can always attend the meeting because it is an open committee meeting if she'd like, and the listserv can be forwarded to her. But right now, it's kind of a little premature to put that in there, or just like put some general statement of somebody from the Central Administration in there. So if anyone has anything else to add, or otherwise I'm just going to call a question on this motion.
How about we could also add in wording what's the word?
No, it means that we stop.
We will add
and we vote on the
ex officio member at a later date.
At a later date. Is it necessary to put it in there if there is already a procedure for putting an ex officio member on next meeting anyway?
What's the value of having an ex officio member?
Usually in governing bodies and committees like that, it's a member, like Ari said, that's generally that is consistently involved in the committee, that it plays like an advisory and discussionary role, but doesn't actually have a vote. It's a little bit more of an involvement than just simply attending the meetings but not having an ex officio role on it. So Susan Murphy would ideally have an ex officio role so that she could guide the discussion of the committee, or not guide it, but more advise it.
A member of the administration guiding this committee?
Not guiding it, more of just serving, like, as you can consult them about certain issues, and they can
but
tell you.
But you can always do that. They don't have to be there.
Well,
it makes us have an official member of the administration so that as a multicultural committee, we know what the administration is already doing on a particular issue. That's not easy to do when the administration is already a part of the committee. However, I agree with you that it shouldn't be belabored, that they can always be invited to the committee later, just to pass this. But it is very helpful to have a member of the administration know what the administration is doing on multicultural issues, because they're doing it there, just so you can have, just so you can facilitate that discussion. My question is, where it says the three graduate or professional students and four employees scratched out, who would those four members be now?
Four members for what?
For
the employees?
Yeah.
That, I was just making a thing, so that's not scratched out.
Okay.
You know what I mean? It's four. I was just, when I was taking that sentence out, I just hit that by mistake.
Okay, so it would still be four employees.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
absolutely. Because there's the only thing that's been deleted right now is the vice provost.
For diversity and faculty development, shall serve as an ex officio member of JAMIC. That's gone. Everything else is there, and this is exactly what the SA passed a month and a half ago.
Okay. Are we ready to vote?
Yes.
Before we lose anymore?
I've got another problem. If you're going to vote, I'll wait. I just got another.
Okay. Ready to vote?
Yes.
Okay. All in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. 11, 0, 0.
And that means that we pass this as an amendment to the charter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and that follows clause number 11.11 in the article number 11 of the charter, which allows us to amend our committee compositions with a two-thirds vote of the city seated of the members of the assembly. Okay.
Is it 11 out of those present or 11 out of the total assembly?
Well, there are some people on the assembly, for example, on this list that are not really fully members.
There, okay, we have an attendance of 11. There are 18 seats that are filled.
Well, Kelly Spicer is 2009. I don't see why she that's a vacant. That's a vacant seat. So it's only, if you say 18 or 17.
So 11 out of 17?
11 out of 17. Is that two-thirds, guys?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Bravo, we did it. We amended the charter.
Adam.
Look at that. We're fantastic. Nice work. That's a great idea.
Okay. Are we quick.
Can I ask?
Yes. Oh, yeah. We need to. Can I have a motion to extend the meeting for about no more than 15 minutes?
15.
Yeah. What about
5? Well, I'm hoping John will be really quick.
Sure. Okay.
Did you approve the minutes? Yeah.
No, we need to go back and do that too.
I second.
Okay. All in favor? Unanimous. What was your question?
That's okay.
No, go ahead.
Hmm?
Go ahead.
It's not.
Okay. All right.
I have a question.
Okay, go ahead.
So, I know Professor Walcott left, but has anyone, since we just passed the creation of a committee, has anyone given any thought to when we would meet?
Who would be
we on? Just passed an ad hoc committee to restructure.
Who's on it?
Well, I don't know.
Who's your executive committee?
Convening.
It will be the executive committee that convenes that.
Okay.
And Charlie and I will need to talk before our next executive committee meeting, which should be the week before our next meeting.
All right.
We will let you all know.
When Payne Consulting finished their business, can we have them come back in for a final report from David Harris?
Bain.
Yeah.
I know it's Bain.
If that's the will of the group, I'm sure we could invite them, but I think we would have to check. You know, make,
they're going to do a final report.
Can we get this resolution okay. down?
Yeah. But no, I was
hold,
serious.
Hold off on that.
Okay.
All right. So, John? CJC.
Oh.
Okay. So, CJC has met a couple times since we have delegated them to look at the provision that the president took issue with. The CJC has considered the president's proposed change, and even the CJC hasn't even been able to come to a consensus on what this would mean for the code and whether this is appropriate, whether we should have more or less. And given that, it's in the way it stands now, there's an inability to come to a consensus, and that the president did ask us to address this. I forget if it's the 14th, I think he had asked this to be addressed by. So in order to have something addressing this, the CJC has recommended that we withdraw our recommendation for this change that was made last year. And it's going to put forth a more extended debate, possibly called something akin to what had happened in previous reviews of the code, call for a campus debate and figure out if/how to address this issue. Because also last semester when this change was made, the CJC has said it really not much was done to even consider the gravity of the issues at play.
Any questions?
No,
we should probably move this first.
What was the
submission?
Protecting free speech, religion. It's saying, or to discriminate, and then there would be a footnote at the bottom, except in cases of free speech, religion, you know, yada, 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 making the or to discriminate meaningless.
And the CJC just said, you can't discriminate, and there'd be a footnote saying that thing, and the CJC can't even figure, well, what does that mean? Is this mean it's going to follow a constitutional standard? Is it going to follow some other standard? And if the CJC is incapable of figuring out what this means, then it really shouldn't be a part of the code until we have some clearer definition of what this
are is. Are you asking the president to deliver that clearer definition of what he's basing that on? Is he basing it on constitutional, on Supreme Court decisions or something like that?
There's been no indication of
can
what
you
it's
get
supposed
him to
mean.
Clarify?
The President Scorton wrote, basically, the problem was that there are some institutions at this university where it is legal to discriminate against, and that to write that would cause problems and complications. And I agree that the language is overly vague. The problem, though, with this resolution is that there should be another be there for resolve clause that says what you're going to put instead. I don't feel comfortable eliminating the discrimination, the only discrimination thing that's ever mentioned in the campus code.
Well, right now it's not even mentioned in the code until the president signs off on it. It's not even mentioned in the code. There's nothing in that provision is not in the code right now because nothing is in the code until the president signs off on it.
But
so right now it's just kind of there in limbo where we recommended it, but the president's not signing off on it. So this is just to get it out of limbo and to say, okay, this is what the code is until we have some more extended provisions put forth, we're going to withdraw our recommendation until we have something more extensive and specific that we can give the president.
But I think that this resolution needs to say what you're putting instead. I don't think
that's
you...
The whole point. That's the whole point. We don't have anything to put instead.
I know, I know, but
are you
sure
for
the resolution?
But
we
want to
have a bigger discussion.
What bigger discussion? We're talking about
that.
Wait.
No one wants to
guys. Please let me address the people who are going to talk, so it makes it more concise and friendlier. I hope the discussion currently on the table is the fact that you would like to add something to the...
I don't think we should withdraw anything from the discrimination part until we have something to replace it with.
Okay. And what we're saying is we're not withdrawing anything. We're withdrawing the proposal that was sent to the president. It's not changing anything in the current code. They want to re-examine it more. So the code is going to remain like it always is, always has been since it was that's passed.
Is it the new code or the old code?
New code.
So the new code is going to be in effect except for this one small provision.
No, excuse me. This is based upon a resolution that was submitted to the president, which had a number of changes in it. This one change caused some problems, which resulted in a footnote, a suggestion, when sent back, not the whole resolution, but this one. What we are trying to do here is, in the next 2 minutes, decide to pull this because the CJC, which is the administrative body to decide what to submit in place of this egregious suggestion that was made, it has to take time to do that, it has to discuss it. So we want to pull that one out so that the rest of the changes which we propose will be accepted and will go into the current code. And if we want to have a discussion about the place of the words or discriminate against as a body, then it's perfectly reasonable for us to pull this one small portion of this larger resolution out of what is being accepted by the president so that everything else in the resolution can go through and we can have that discussion at a future meeting.
Right.
So I don't know whether the resolution's been moved, but I second it if it has. And if it hasn't, I move this resolution.
Okay. Moved by Marty.
Second.
By Leon.
And I call a question on it.
Vote on call to question. All in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Opposed?
No, I'm not opposed. I just want to make sure I know what I'm doing.
Okay.
Okay.
So there's 1, 2, 8, 801. And is that enough?
Only 9.
We need 10.
No, we don't.
11 people are on the table.
No.
1, 2. I can't vote. One, two, let's vote again. I can't count tonight. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 901.
Okay.
Perfect.
So the question passed.
And the question has been called. Shall we move to voting on the resolution, please?
We have.
All those in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 8 in approval, those not approving? 1. Any abstentions? And 1. So it passes 8-1-1. Okay.
So we can schedule discussion of this particular clause at our next meeting. And we can be a little clearer about what is the problem for this.
And they can
share us by having us a representative come in.
John, may I recommend that you have legal counsel visit the CJC meeting?
Okay, I'll
send them
an email. It'll probably be next Monday.
We're not done yet. I need to vote on the minutes from the last meeting. Who would like to move the meeting? No, the notes.
I'll move the last minute.
Okay, so moved by Idris and seconded by William.
Ronnie, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
The Family Services report that was passed at the last meeting, which had just the president's statement, which we approved,
mm-hmm.
and I forget the woman's name, but she said she was going to.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was going to type up the changes and send it to you. Did she ever send
it? She did, and I submitted them last week.
Okay, because the website doesn't have the approved. It's just linked to something else.
Oh, because I need to send them to Amy. I haven't done that.
Okay.
No, we need to vote on the minutes first. I need a vote for the minutes, last week's minutes, or last meeting's minutes. All those in favor, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, opposed, abstention, 1, 8-0-1. Motion to adjourn?
Second.
Idris and Leon, all those in favor? Thank you.
I think that's
kind of it. I'm trying to get out of here. I need to send those to Amy. I forgot to do that.
Okay, yeah. Because it just says, well, she's going to make the changes and write it to you, but without the changes being in the minutes, I want to read that before.
Okay.
That is why I was asking.
Yeah, I forgot to send them to her. It's amazing.
Thank you.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.